Okay, thank you, because I start by saying that I was never really a big fan of history at school. And I think the reason for that is precisely why we have this discussion today, because at school, history was, as has just been mentioned, always represented basically in a very superficial way. I give two examples that always struck me as very obvious. One, the collapse of the Roman Empire. It's basically made it out that, you know, suddenly out of nowhere these barbarian hordes come along and that's the end of the Roman Empire. It just kind of collapses inexplicably. But then you have to ask, well, why at that point? Why not earlier? This was always a question that kind of stuck in my mind. Or even more obvious was the example of World War I, where they were told, so there was an archduke who's Franz Ferdinand who's assassinated, and suddenly all the powers are kind of battling out amongst themselves on a world scale. And that, even as a child, it was just quite clear. This can clearly not be the cause behind a whole world war. So basically, you know, this was what really always used to annoy me, was that history was presented in this superficial way that was basically, as has been said, like a series of accidents. It's just a series of random events with no real kind of underlying cause or process going on. The other very kind of superficial explanation of history that you often see put forward, and it's along the same sort of strand, is that history is basically a series of great men and women, and that there's simply a kind of battle of individual personalities and a battle of ideas. One very good example of this that in the modern age, actually, is a documentary maker called Adam Curtis, who some might have seen. He's a kind of left-wing documentary maker, makes social, political documentaries. But more and more, as he's become more and more famous, actually, he's become more and more superficial and really idealistic in his interpretation of events. He likes to paint a kind of narrative, a story of events that's very simplified. Like one of the ones he did recently was basically explaining the rise of neoliberalism, where he said, once upon a time there was a woman called Ayn Rand, and she wrote a book called Atlas Shrugged, and then a man called Alan Greenspan read it, and then Alan Greenspan became the treasurer, and then he installed neoliberalism. And you just think, wow, what a fortuitous series of events that have led to this neoliberalism. And you kind of think, well, you know, this clearly can't really be an explanation. Another good example of this is the film Lincoln that's just come out, where basically from this kind of portrait, this Hollywoodized version of history, it's basically showed that the emancipation of the slaves was purely the act of this one man's kind of benevolence, his one great idea, ultimately really presented as a moral question above all else. Now, this kind of idea of great men or women in history, you know, begs the question, why some great women, why some great men and not others? Why are some ideas able to dominate in certain periods and not others? You know, why can Ayn Rand write a book that creates an entire neoliberal movement, but I can't write a book that does the equal same? Why can't Marxists be, why hasn't anyone just, you know, written the book to end all books, to begin the socialist movement? Now, ultimately, all of these kind of ways of looking at history, either as a series of individuals or a series of kind of accidents, effectively, which I'll come on to later, are really the same thing. All of this represents what we call the idealistic interpretation of history, really not really giving any explanation to history at all. Now, Marx and Engels came along and really turned the whole process on its head and said that it's not so much individuals that create history, but histories that create great individuals, if you like. And that it's not so much a battle of ideas, but a battle of class struggle. And you see this in the opening lines of the Communist Manifesto, the idea that all hitherto written history is the history of class struggle. Now, when they're talking about history in this sense, there can also be sometimes a kind of almost supernatural side to it. It can almost feel like a mystical quality. There's this, you know, it's no longer great men and women, but there's this mystical history that's kind of pushing us on, these forces that people talk about. Now, Marx actually was very clear that this kind of mysticism equally had nothing to do with historical materialism, with the method of Marxism, where he said in his brilliantly titled book, The Critique of Critical Criticism. I think that's my favourite title of any Marx writing ever. He said, history does nothing. It possesses no immense wealth. It wages no battles. It is man, real living man, that does all, that possesses and fights. History is not a person apart, using man as a means for its own particular aims. History is nothing but the aim of man pursuing, is the activity of man pursuing his aims. And I think that's really the starting point when we talk about historical materialism. Now, between these two kind of contrasting views of history, this idealistic interpretation and the materialist one of Marx and Engels, is really, as I say, it's a philosophical difference at heart between idealism and materialism, which I'm sure was discussed in the first session today, actually. And basically, the historical materialism is an extension, if you like, or just an application of dialectical materialism to the social political world. In philosophy, we draw the distinction between being and consciousness. And idealism says that consciousness is primary, that being is secondary, that consciousness determines being. Whereas materialists, again, turn the question on its head and say, no, it's actually being that determines consciousness. Now, with historical materialism, it's the same concept, the same relationship, but now taken onto the social plane, where we're talking about what creates not just consciousness in your head, but class consciousness. What is it that creates the ideas in society as a whole? And Marx very clearly outlined this by saying that it was the social conditions that led social material conditions that led to social consciousness, and this was most famously outlined in his preface to a contribution of the Critique of Political Economy, where he says, in the social production of their life, men enter into definite relations that are indispensable and independent of their will. Relations of production which correspond to a definite stage of development of their material productive forces. The sum of these total relations of production constitutes the economic structure of society, the real foundation on which rises a legal and political superstructure and to which corresponds forms of social consciousness. The mode of material life conditions the social, political and intellectual life processes in general. It is not the consciousness of men that determines their being, but on the contrary, their social being that determines their consciousness. And this was really a revolutionary couple of paragraphs in the outlook of how to look at history and the relationship between social ideas and really the key part of all this, which, as has already been mentioned, the development of the productive forces. So really what we're getting at with historical materialism is this idea that it's material conditions ultimately that determine ideas and not the other way around. But to be a bit more concrete about it, what do we really mean by people's relationship to the means of production? What do we mean by these kind of material conditions? At heart, as Marx says, it's about man trying to pursue his material aims, just going about trying to live, trying to put food on the table and a house over your head. And in doing so, you can't do this in an individual manner. Society forces you to interact with other people in order to achieve these aims. And it's those interactions that give rise to classes and to class consciousness in turn. So what do we mean by the relationship to the means of production? Well, do you have inheritance? Do you own a business or have shares? If so, you're kind of aristocracy or bourgeois. Are you self-employed or have a small business of your own, the petty bourgeoisie? Or, like the majority of people, do you, in order to get food on the table, have to go and earn a wage by selling the only thing that you have, really, which is your own labour power, and having to work for someone else? Now, when you kind of strip away all the other factors in society, it's this, ultimately, Marx and Engels said, that is really at the heart of what determines consciousness. This factor in terms of the relationship between people and the means of production. Now, as I said, the idealists really look at history as kind of a series of great men and women, which in essence is just a series of random accidents, if you like. But that whole kind of premise assumes that there isn't really any progress, so to speak, that, you know, if everything is just random, there's no kind of laws or, you know, no historical laws or tendencies that we can really derive. It makes history effectively completely unpredictable. It puts it on this kind of postmodern level where it's no longer a science at all. And Marxism is all about trying to make history putting it on a solid scientific basis, in the same way that kind of the materialists in kind of the natural sciences had done before Marx and Engels. Now, the fact is, if you do look at history and you study it, whilst you can't come up with, say, iron laws like you can in mechanics, you can come up still with general tendencies. There is general patterns that you can observe. And the most fundamental of these, the one that Marx and Engels really struck on, was the development of the means of production. This is progress in a scientific sense. And what do we mean by that? Well, generally speaking, today is better than yesterday, and tomorrow will be better than today. That is a general law you see throughout history. The development of the means of production, the ability to have a mastery over nature, to be able to manipulate our surroundings to our own advantage in order to improve our living standards. The development of science, technique, and machinery, the development of our knowledge about the world and how we can use that to our own advantage. This is, if you like, the real motor force of history. This is what drives towards society above all else. And this is a general law that you can see from looking back at history. But obviously, to paint it in that kind of manner, that just presenting that one side, is in itself a kind of mechanical interpretation of history, because it's not a continual upward march from you know, lower to higher stages. There's, as we mentioned yesterday in the opening session, there are periods in history where, in fact, there isn't progress, where actually there's stagnation, where there's decline, where society can actually go backwards, The whole process is not a very simple kind of deterministic one that plays out like clockwork, but one which progresses through contradictions, through primarily class struggle, as we talked about, where you have this kind of dialectical process, if you like, of ebb and flow, periods of growth followed by periods of stagnation and decline. And Marx and Engels said that these periods of decline, of stagnation, were ultimately the periods where the development of the productive forces had come into conflict with the relations of production, or, to put it in legal terms, they said, with property relations, and that therefore there was fundamentally, in these times, in order to carry on developing society, in order to carry on developing science, technology, knowledge, and so forth, there was actually would need to be a fundamental change in society altogether. So this, if you like, gives you the other kind of general tendency that you can observe in history, which is the history of class struggle that we referred to earlier. It's a general law of history that there will be revolution in periods where the productive forces stagnate, and where there is a fundamental need to change society in order to carry on developing the productive forces. Now, there was, in terms of this idea of progress in history, there was an idea of progress in a historical sense before Marx and Engels, but it was fundamentally associated, really, ultimately, with Hegel, Hegelian ideas of progress, where it was no longer a materialist conception of progress, but an idealistic one. Hegel, the famous German philosopher, was a dialectician, but an idealistic one, and he had an idea of progress as being something teleological, somewhere where there was a definitive endpoint that history was progressing for, and that was kind of governed by this absolute spirit that he saw. Now, as again we discussed last night, there is no such thing as the end of history. You know, Marxists don't have this concept of a kind of mechanical, deterministic kind of upward march of society towards some sort of end goal. And in fact, this idea of end of history, as was pointed out yesterday, is something actually the bourgeois have quoted and used in order to justify the kind of superiority in their mind of neoliberalism. Now, for Marxists, you have to look at progress in a materialist way, as was said yesterday, not in a moral way. We're not talking about progress in terms of you know, viewing it from our own standpoint of today, but trying to look at it in a more objective sense. Now, you know, as was pointed out yesterday, if you look at history in a moral way, it really gets you nowhere, because for a start, morality is constantly changing, and it's changing as a reflection primarily of the interests of the ruling class, and in terms of maintaining current social relations. So I think the examples that were given yesterday actually highlight this very very well. The example of slavery, for example, you know, in a moral sense, slavery is abhorrent. It's always been abhorrent, and you know, we can say that for certain now. But nevertheless, at the time, it was morally justified by the ruling class. It was considered to be the natural state of affairs, and really, in a scientific sense, it actually played a very progressive role in developing the means of production, enabling a small minority to free themselves from the kind of graft of manual labour and to be able to spend time philosophising, coming up with science and culture. And as was quoted yesterday, Hegel said it's not so much from slavery that humanity saves itself, but it's through slavery that humanity is emancipated. And in fact, to go back to my original example, the collapse of the Roman Empire, you can see how slavery, although progressive for a period of time, also in a dialectical way turned into its opposite. You know, the very same things that gave slavery an impetus to develop the productive forces also turn into their opposite and end up causing the collapse of the Roman Empire. You have slavery effectively is basing production on a very low level of productivity, and it requires the constant expansion absorption of new slaves into the system at a low cost. And this led to the continual kind of expansion of the Roman Empire, the continual needing to fight new battles to expand the borders, until it gets to the point where they, you know, there isn't the means of communication to keep in touch with these borders, where they don't really know what's going on, and where they're very weak, therefore, at the edge of the empire. And ultimately, the whole system kind of collapses in on itself with this seeming kind of random accident of the barbarian hordes coming in from the east. Now, it was also discussed about capitalism. You know, in a kind of postmodernist or moral sense, you know, we'd have to look at capitalism and say it's always been horrible. You know, it's always been an exploitative. But Marx and Engels, when you read the Communist Manifesto, and this is something that a lot of people don't seem to realize when especially the bourgeoisie, people don't realize how much Marx and Engels really appreciated the progressive side of capitalism in its heyday. You know, the quote in the Communist Manifesto of how it's created wonders far surpassing Egyptian pyramids, Roman aqueducts. You know, this is them describing how the progressive side of capitalism, the competition that forced people to reinvest in new machinery, in new research, in new development, was initially a great impetus to the development of the means of production. But in a moral sense, Marx also said, you know, as was quoted yesterday, capitalism came into existence with blood dripping from every pore. In a moral sense, capitalism has never been, you know, progressive, but in a scientific sense, it did very clearly develop the means of production to an extraordinary extent, and thereby lay the material foundations for a new society based on superabundance and not on scarcity. And that, if you like, is the historical role of capitalism, which it's no longer able to do. Now, I'd say that really this kind of moralistic way of looking at and postmodern way of looking at progress really is ultimately a reflection of the age we live in, a kind of period of where there is stagnation, where there is decline, where capitalism isn't able to actually develop society anymore. And therefore, there's this incredible pessimism, as was said yesterday, you know, this constant idea of we don't have enough anymore, you know, we're destroying the planet. Yes, we're destroying the planet, but is that a problem with the system, or just a problem, you know, innately with production? People who argue that we need to go all the way back to kind of pre-industrial age in order to carry on living. And that's if you like, reflection, the pessimism that's shown by this society, which is stagnating, which isn't able to offer a sustainable future for humanity. Is also reflected, I think, in the Economist the other week. They had an article, front page headline, saying, "Has innovation ended?" And they had a whole briefing discussing, you know, has scientific innovation ended? Have we reached the point where we're no longer able to come up with new labor saving devices? Where you know, basically society kind of grinds to a halt. Now they actually said no to this, which was to their credit, but from an opposite class perspective, it has to be pointed out. But nevertheless, just the asking of this question shows there is this deep pessimism now in society about the idea of progress because capitalism is no longer able to offer it. Now, as well as avoiding a kind of idealistic interpretation of history, we also have to make sure that when we talk about historical materialism, we're not talking about a kind of mechanical materialism, which really actually ultimately turns into its opposite again and becomes idealistic, in the sense that if you paint history as being this kind of upward march with which is happening in a deterministic fashion with no kind of ebbs and flows but just continually heading in one inevitable direction, if you like, then that ultimately is just as idealistic as saying history is a series of random processes in the first place. And actually, this is an accusation you often find levelled against Marx and Engels, is that they said socialism is inevitable, you know, that actually capitalism will just kind of collapse of its own accord and socialism will just inevitably rise out of its place. In other words, that, you know, almost implying that you could just sit back and wait for the revolution to happen. Now, I mean, obviously, if that was the case, then I doubt Marx would have put himself through the turmoil and the torment of writing three volumes of Capital. If he thought capitalism was just going to self-implode, what's the point in writing about 3,000 pages to describe that? And what was the point, as we discussed this morning, of building the First International, of trying to actually make an active change? Obviously, Marx and Engels didn't have this interpretation of history. It's something that's been levelled against them in academia. And in fact, you know, as has been said, for Marx, the question was not that of inevitable socialism, but socialism or barbarism, pointing out that society did not inevitably progress upwards. It's a general tendency you see in history, but that without a revolution, without the working class coming to power, there could be an enormous step backwards for society. There could be a decay into barbarism where we do destroy the planet, where we do destroy each other. Now, similarly, there is often, I think, in a kind of Stalinist fashion as well, this is particularly the result of Stalinism, the view of history as kind of these stages of history where you can very clearly delineate one era from another. Now, it's true that there is, if you like, you can look at history and see periods where there is a qualitative difference between one and the other. But, you know, often when you hear a talk about historical materialism, it's painted, you know, here is how history developed. It was slavery, and then it was feudalism, and then it was capitalism. And it's just these kind of three definitive stages. Now, whilst there is a qualitative difference in these different eras of history, I don't think personally that useful to talk about history in that kind of way, because it paints it again as some sort of inevitable progression that had to go along these lines. If you look elsewhere in the world, there was different developments of history, and, you know, really painting it as simply these stages, if you like, is kind of one-sided and a bit incomplete. But what we're talking about here is really an abstraction in history. And this is an important point when it comes to the method of Marxism. Marxism consistently in all areas is used to make abstraction. We use abstraction all the time in life. But we also have to look at the concrete situation, look at the actual concrete processes that are going on, the interconnections and the dynamism, if you like, of what's going on. In terms of these stages, yes, there are eras where there is a dominant mode of production. It's a dominant set of laws, if you like, that society operates under. There are certain laws within a slave economy that exert themselves at a certain level. when slavery reaches a kind of certain size. But it's not to say that you didn't have then slavery as a particular kind of feature under former societies. You still had slavery and the feudalism and capitalism. And equally, you know, even now we have kind of elements of feudalism within capitalism today, the monarchy and so forth. Equally, you had kind of elements of capitalism within the old societies. You would have, within slave societies, within feudal societies, you would have still had commodity production, money and merchants, finance capital, these sorts of things, or not so much capital, but finance, usury, I mean to say. Now, the point is that these things exist within the old society. So when we're talking about stages in history, it can sometimes come across a bit mechanically, because what we're really trying to get at here is that history is an evolving process, but not one in a linear fashion, but in a dialectical fashion, with ebbs and flows, where the new society is always born within the womb of the old. And that's really the key idea that Marx and Engels outline within the Communist Manifesto, talking about how the towns in industry, the world market, the development of the working class itself, all of these were kind of born within feudalism, if you like. And the real qualitative change happens in those revolutionary periods in history where there's a transformation as to who really controls the means of production in a legal sense. Now, in this respect, we can see socialism as an embryo within capitalism. We can see an interconnected world. We can see the development of huge multinational companies that span the entire globe, which are planned very much within the company. There is an immense degree of a planned economy, if you like, but within the economy of a single company. So you can see the possibility of socialism within these within this development, the fact that there is planning there, but it's done in the interest of profit, and all that's needed is to now have planning between different companies to get rid of the anarchy of capitalism and to be able to actually put production on a rational planned basis rather than the irrational anarchy of capitalism. You also see within capitalism even the development of workers' democracy. You know, the creation of the trade unions are, in fact, the embryo, if you like, of a future workers' democracy under socialism. Now, when we talk about laws within history, what we're talking about here is not mechanical laws of history, not things that are, if you like, written into the fabric of the universe, but dialectical laws, which I'm sure was discussed earlier today. In other words, observable patterns that we can see arising out of history itself. Now, again, these aren't things that are kind of, you know, written into the sky, written into the universe, but are things that result precisely from, as Marx described earlier, from man trying to pursue his own aims, pursue his own needs, being forced to interact with others. And it's this interaction of all the different individuals which, pursuing, if you like, seemingly random aims, you can't predict what the individual behaviour of any one of us will be, really. That's an unpredictable, random process, seemingly. But yet, from the many interactions of all of us having to interact for going about our meeting our material needs, certain patterns are created. And this is, again, a very kind of dialectical concept, if you like, of the idea of order arising out of chaos, kind of predictability arising out of something that seems to be random. You know, and this is very much what you can see within capitalism. When people tell you, you know, social sciences can never be a science because it's too complex, there's too many variables, you can say, yeah, it's not obviously that we can predict history in a scientific way that you can predict the motion of the planets. But nevertheless, at a certain level, you can see certain observable trends and you can make definite predictions, such as the inevitability of capitalism going into crisis and revolutionary movements. In other words, you see these patterns emerging from a seemingly random process. Equally, in terms of avoiding this kind of mechanical interpretation of history, we have to avoid this kind of economic determinism. Again, another thing that's always leveled at Marxism. You know, the only thing that we care about is economics, that nothing else matters. And again, this is a kind of crude distortion of Marxism, really, which comes about partly from this, again, a bit of a Stalinist idea of this base superstructure. And that this analogy is used in a way that basically gets rid of all the dialectics of history, if you like, the dialectical element of historical materialism, where it's painted as though there's simply, you know, this base and there's a mechanical link to society above it, the superstructure of politics, of ideas, of the state, of the family, of religion, morality, that there's some sort of mechanical link that just connects the two, the economy to everything else, and as soon as the economy changes at all, it's going to be instantly reflected in the superstructure. Now, Marx and Engels never really had this kind of concept at all. In fact, for them, there was, as I said, a very dialectical relationship between the economy and the superstructure, one where, you know, didn't deny the role of ideas in being able to play an important role in history, but nevertheless looked to determine where those ideas came from and gave them a material basis. And also, importantly, showed that there's a constant interaction between your economic base and your superstructure, a constant process of feedback where, you know, ideas and morality and culture, once they have been created, can develop their own logic and can play an important role, but are ultimately kept within limits, if you like, by the economic base in society. You know, this idea of the development of the productive forces, the current mode of production, limits, if you like, the ability to which certain ideas or certain individuals can actually play a role in history. And I think it's worth giving a few examples of this. So, for example, part of the superstructure that's talked about is the idea of the state, where, again, it's said the state should ultimately correspond, the form of the state should correspond to the kind of economic base underneath, if you like. But yet, when you really look at history, you can see an enormous variation in the kind of political regimes and the types of state that are used, even within the same economic mode of production. So, for example, if you look just within France, a good example from the French Revolution through to the 20th century, and all the huge variation in political superstructures that you had, yet within the same kind of capitalist France, where you go from the Jacobins and the revolutionaries to the Thermidor and Bonapartism, the restoration of monarchy, then the Third Republic, and then all the way through to kind of De Gaulle. All of these incredibly varied different forms of government in France, and yet underneath, all of them ultimately supporting the same economic base, that of capitalism. And in fact, when Engels was talking about the origin of the state in his book, The Origins of the Family, Private Property and the State, he's very clear, and Lenin later highlights this in Stalin Revolution, it's very clear to point out the non-mechanical nature, if you like, of this relationship, of talking about, you know, in general this is the case, and but also recognizing that there could always be particular cases which are different, and pointing out that the state could always have a certain independence, if you like, hence the kind of phenomena of Bonapartism, as we call it, where you can get kind of military regimes or so forth, or kind of all the way up to elements of fascism, where seemingly the state actually attacks the very people that it's supposed to be representing. Caesarism is similar to this. The idea that Julius Caesar, yes, probably killed and expropriated many individual slave owners, and yet ultimately represented the slave-owning class. Similarly with Bonaparte himself, as Marx describes in his pamphlet on the 18th Brumaire, you know, would kill several, you know, many capitalists, individual capitalists, but nevertheless represented capitalism as a whole. We can also see this within the law, the morality, and as I'm sure has been discussed right now within the family, how you can have a development of the family, but yet ultimately the form that the family takes is conditioned by the economic kind of relations in society. The idea that when you had primitive communism, there was no real need to distinguish, you know, the nuclear family, if you like, of having mother, father, and their children. It was tribes where children are raised communally, and it's only with the development of private property that you have the need for inheritance and the need, therefore, to specify which children belong to which parents and, therefore, who inherits what wealth. Now, similarly, in terms of seeing how the economic situation limits, if you like, the role that any idea or so forth can play, we can also see this in terms of the role of the individual in history, where, again, as I said at the beginning, it's this very idealistic interpretation to think that it's great men and women who drive history forwards with their great ideas. Now, Marxists would never deny, if you like, the important role that certain individuals can play in history. But, again, it would point out, Marxism always points out that these individuals are limited as to what they can achieve by the economic situation at their disposal, by the objective conditions. And this was famously summed up in the opening paragraphs of Marx's 18th Brumaire, Louis Bonaparte, where he talks about, men make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under circumstances directly encountered, given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brain of the living. Now, this is, if you like, the Marxist conception of the role of the individual in history, not as the driving force, but rather the product of history, where effectively what we're talking about, again, is this dialectical relationship between accident and necessity, which, again, might have been discussed this morning. I wasn't actually in that session. But what we're saying here is that an individual can achieve certain great things, but only provided that all the other kind of objective conditions are there, all the right material is there in order for them to play a certain role. You know, in looking outside of this idea of the role of history, other kind of historical phenomena, if you like, that show the same relationship. You know, it's often said that the oil crisis of 1973 led to the huge economic crisis that then kind of went spread across the world in the 70s. Now, this again is, if you like, the relationship between accident and necessity, because, if you like, there's been many oil surges in history. I'm sure there's been many times where the price of oil has shot up. But in this particular situation, where the productive forces have outgrown their own limits, where you've got overproduction, and where also, you know, profit has been declining gradually over the 2 decades beforehand, then all it takes is, if you like, this accident, this one little surge, or at the time quite large surge in the oil price, and suddenly everyone's it has this cataclysmic effect on the whole economy. If you like, it's really reflecting the necessity of the economy at that point to go into crisis, and all it takes is that one little push to force it over the edge. The other is this very other good example is this very commonly used phrase to describe chaos theory, where they talk about a butterfly flapping its wings and creating a tornado on the other side of the world, or a hurricane. Now, clearly the butterfly flapping its wings is not what causes the hurricane. It's just that within certain conditions where all the other factors are already present, the small change in one place can lead to a huge development elsewhere. And this, if you like, is the same in terms of the role of individuals in history. That it's that really the presence of this or that individual is merely a historical accident. But their particular role shows the necessity, if you like, which ultimately is an economic necessity, for certain things to happen, for the need for great men, if you like. As I said at the beginning, great men do not create history. It's history that creates great men. Engels, I think, sums this up very well in a letter he wrote, where he said, again, men make their history themselves, but not as yet with a collective will or according to a collective plan, or even in a definitely defined given society. Their efforts clash, and for that very reason, all such societies are governed by necessity, which is supplemented by and appears under the forms of accident. The necessity which here asserts itself amidst all accident is again ultimately economic necessity. This is where the so-called great men come in for treatment. That such a man, and precisely that man, arises at that particular time in that given country is of course pure accident. But cut him out and there will be a demand for a substitute. And this substitute will be found, good or bad, but in the long run he must be found. That Napoleon, just as that particular courtesan, should have been the military dictator whom the French Republic, exhausted by its own war, had rendered necessary, was an accident. But that, if a Napoleon had been lacking, another would have filled the place, is proved by the fact that man has always been found as soon as he became necessary. Caesar, Augustus, Cromwell, etc. And this is another actually important point, is that you do see very similar types of figures emerging in very similar historical conditions. You do see these kind of strong men of history, if you like, Cromwell, Robespierre, Lincoln, emerging in these periods where there is the need for a representative of the emerging bourgeois class to come through and battle against all else, battle against the prevailing views of the time in order to push through the economic necessity. And that's, if you like, the real history of Abraham Lincoln that isn't given in the Spielberg version that's out of the cinemas at the moment, which I do not recommend seeing. It's rubbish. Save your money. In fact, what you see in a lot of these cases is, again, it's history that creates the individual. You know, if you go to the example that Marx gives of Louis Bonaparte, he writes this whole book about, this whole series of articles. He points out that Louis Bonaparte was not chosen because of his exceptional individual qualities, but actually precisely for the lack of individual qualities that he had. In other words, you know, he was a boring man, an incredibly boring blank canvas, who all the different social classes that were battling out at the time could kind of transmit project their views onto. He was, if you like, he was whatever you wanted him to be. And for that role, he played in a very important role in history, where he could kind of lean on the different social classes and in this Bonapartist fashion. Now, it's very similar to to Stalin, really, where often we say how it's not so much that Stalin chose the bureaucracy, but rather the bureaucracy chose Stalin. They chose someone in their own image. They chose a bland, boring man who wasn't, a nice, florid theoretician like Trotsky. They chose a strong man, a brute, someone who was a bureaucrat who would carry out policies in the interest of the bureaucracy themselves. In this sense, again, you're turning history on its head from how it's normally painted, where Stalin was a great individual, or not so great, but in any case, an individual who was a strong man who forced his policies on society, and that's the history of Stalinism, if you like. That's the necessary result of Marxism. Whereas, obviously, as Marxists and as Trotsky explained, Stalinism is the product of history. It's the product of historical conditions, specific material conditions, where you have a planned economy in an incredibly backward country, where there isn't the development of the productive forces to allow people the time to participate in the running of society. Again, it comes back to this question, the development of the productive forces. Do you have the ability to produce enough for everyone without having to work so long that you can't participate in the rest of the running of society? If that's the case, as it was in Russia, if people are having to work 15, 16 hours a day just to get by, then you can't talk of a democratic planned economy, because people are too busy working in the fields, people are too busy working in the factories just to produce what's necessary. And therefore, in that situation, it's inevitable that a bureaucracy will emerge, that people can't participate in the running society, therefore they delegate that responsibility to precisely a bureaucracy, to officials who, because of scarcity, make sure that the scarce resources in society go to their own families, go to their own villages, and in that way distort the planned economy and create this monstrous bureaucracy. So in other words, you know, we as Marxists are always looking for the material causes which ultimately have to be based in the development of the productive forces to explain these processes in history, not just talking about great individuals or strong men, as is blamed in terms of the cause of Stalinism from the bourgeois. Yes, in other words, what you see with this, again, with this idealistic interpretation of history is turning the whole thing on its head. Rather than, you know, well, basically, what the idealists see is that they think it's leaders who impose their desires on the masses. But it's the other way around. The masses impose their desires on their leaders. Leaders reflect the movement from below. Good example of this is Chavez in Venezuela. Again, from the bourgeois perspective, what's happening in Venezuela right now is purely the result of Chavez. It's purely a kind of cult of personality, if you like. And it's true that Chavez plays a very important role in Venezuela. He keeps different kind of warring factions within the movement kind of held together. Different elements of bureaucracy that are below him are kind of united under his kind of political authority, if you like. But really, what you see with Chavez is the product of the pressures from below. It's the product of the need for the development of society in Venezuela, where you had years of austerity, and there was the need for breaking with the kind of neoliberal policies that had been imposed by the IMF in the past. And Chavez, who comes initially to power as kind of a left nationalist, talking just about, you know, nationalizing the oil wealth, is very quickly pushed further to the left by the events of the coup in 2002 and later events and the masses pressuring from below, and is forced now to talk about socialism and revolution, and that's something that the bourgeois can never really understand, that this is really a revolution that's taking place in Venezuela, a very protracted one over many numbers of years because of the absence of a revolutionary party, but nevertheless a revolution and not just a cult of personality. So this is really, if you like, the role of the individual in history, which, as we say, can play a very important role, but only given the necessary and the correct objective conditions elsewhere. And you don't have to look any further to kind of prove this point, to emphasize this point, than the Bolsheviks and Lenin in Russia, where you say the Bolsheviks and Lenin in particular played an incredibly important role. The presence of them is undeniable. That really was the success of the Russian Revolution over all other revolutions that failed. The presence of a revolutionary party that was educated in Marxist ideas over a long period of time and was able to put forward the right ideas at the right time in the right manner. But nevertheless, obviously, they were only able to do that with the objective conditions of a revolutionary radicalization in society from the February Revolution onwards. Now, this whole materialist conception of history was also a big break with the other socialists who'd come before Marx and Engels, in particular the utopian socialists, who thought that, again, socialism was just the product of great individuals with great ideas. If they could develop a perfect idea of what a future socialist society would look like, then they could educate the masses in it and convince everyone that this was necessary. And in other words, socialism was purely a moral question of being able to prove its superiority in an intellectual or theoretical fashion over capitalism. And again, in this sense, history basically just appears as accident, as Engels points out in his pamphlet, Socialism, Utopian and Scientific, where he says, for these utopian socialists, what was wanted was the individual man of genius who has now arisen and who understands the truth. That he has now arisen, that the truth has now been clearly understood, is not an inevitable event following of necessity in the chain of historical development, but a mere happy accident. He might as well just have been born 500 years earlier and might have spared humanity 500 years of error, strife and suffering. So in other words, for these utopians, socialism was completely independent of material conditions, completely independent of the historical development of mankind and of the productive forces, that you could just have socialism at any point in time. Now, Marx and Engels, again, argued against this, pointing out that socialism required certain material conditions. It required superabundance. It required the development of productivity to the point where you could reduce the amount that everyone had to work so that there was this time to participate in society. And as Marx said very very famously, you know, as long as there is want, all the old crap will remain. You know, the socialism was only possible thanks to, if you like, the historically progressive role that capitalism had played, but now was no longer able to play. Now, historical materialism, as I said, is really this application of dialectical materialism, or an extension of it. It's not a separate thing altogether. It's really just part of the same set of ideas, in that what we're doing here is generalizing and abstracting from an infinitely complex process. You know, the stages that I talked about earlier are in some senses an abstraction, but a very useful one, where you talk about qualitatively different periods where there are different kind of dominant laws that assert themselves. But similarly, you know, history is not just a series of factors or forces, if you like, as it's often described. Again, it's giving this kind of mechanical image of a clockwork system where it's just you know, pulling cogs and wheels and so forth. And this is what Plekhanov actually describes very well in his pamphlet on the materialist conception of history, where he says a historical social factor is an abstraction, and the idea of it originates as the result of a process of abstraction. Thanks to the process of abstraction, various sides of the social complex assume the form of separate categories, and the various manifestations and expressions of the activity of social man, morals, laws, economic forms, etc., are converted in our minds into separate forces, which appear to give rise to and determine this activity and to be its ultimate causes. And he sums this up right at the end of the pamphlet, saying out that it turns out that when historical factors, that they are mere abstractions, and when the mist surrounding them is dispelled, it becomes clear that men do not make several distinct histories, the history of law, the history of morals, the history of philosophy, but only one history, the history of their own social relations, which are determined by the state of the productive forces in each particular period. What is known as the ideologies is nothing but a multiform reflection in the minds of men of the single and indivisible history. So in other words, he's arguing here against this idea that you can separate history out into all these different forces and factors, if you like, but that ultimately these are reflections, abstractions we've created, in some sense, of one history, of a very real material history, as I said earlier, of this history of people trying to go about achieving their aims and being forced to interact and creating certain laws as a result of that. Now, in this sense, when we talk about history and we have certain terms that we use, we have to recognize that these are also kind of useful but still generalized abstractions. For example, when we use the term a bourgeois revolution, what do we really mean by that? You know, there is no such thing, if you like, as a bourgeois revolution, in the sense that no particular revolution ever has all the kind of qualities and characteristics of bourgeois revolution in general. Every revolution has its own specific factors, its own specific conditions, its own religion, its own culture, its own nationality, all of these sort of things. You know, if you look at the bourgeois revolution, the kind of classical bourgeois revolutions of Holland, of England, of France, and USA, all of them will have their own particular way in which they developed. In that sense, no specific revolution looks like this kind of abstraction of bourgeois revolution itself. But nevertheless, when you strip away all these factors, you do see common processes, common general tendencies that you see throughout all these different things, in terms of general tendencies of certain classes, you know, conflicting in defense of certain certain interests. Now, the reason I highlight this is because equally, there is no such thing as a pure socialist revolution, if you like. This, again, is a kind of abstraction. Lenin said, "He who wishes to see a pure revolution will never live to see one." And this is something that a lot of so-called Marxists actually fail to understand. They imagine that every revolution will play out in a kind of ideal manner, you know, with an ideal working class that is ideally conscious of itself, with an ideal revolutionary party leading the ideal revolution to the ideal of socialism. And the whole point is, all the way along this process, it is idealistic, and the real process is never does never conform to the actual ideal itself. The point is that revolutions don't happen out of ideals. They don't happen out of the kind of the persuasion or the great ideas of us as revolutions. They happen out of objective necessity. And the point is that in the absence of the revolutionary party that can channel that that revolution, that anger, into a useful direction and can lead it towards socialism, in the absence of that, revolutions can take all sorts of distorted manners. And this was really, if you like, the crux of Ted Grant's contribution in terms of the, looking at the colonial revolutions and proletarian Bonapartism, showing that, you know, in these countries, you had all sorts of distorted forms of worker states, deformed worker states, created because of the absence of a revolutionary party and because of the kind of stagnation and the crimes of Stalinism on an international level, which led to all sorts of bizarre regimes ruling over kind of nationalized planned economies in Egypt, in Syria, in Ethiopia, even in Cuba. You know, all of these sort of things were clearly not your ideal worker state. They were not a healthy worker state. They did not have socialist democracy. But they developed out of objective necessity, because in all these countries, there was a need to develop the productive forces, a need to improve living standards, to go further than what capitalism and imperialism could offer. But in the absence of a revolutionary party, all sorts of bizarre regimes can emerge, like Castro, who wasn't a communist really at the beginning at all, but was moved in that direction, again, by the pressure from below. Now, finally, just to say that, you know, again, Marxism is not it's not a kind of a scientific law that you can use in the same way of predicting the motion of the planets. Historical materialism does not provide us with a crystal ball. We should treat history as a science, of course, but also remember that what we're discovering here are general laws, general tendencies, general patterns, but then nevertheless, you know, the lessons that we learn from history by looking back at the past have always got to be applied to the concrete, specific conditions of today if we're really to understand what's going on now. We can't just abstractly use the examples of the past and impose them in a mechanical fashion onto the conditions of today. We have to look at the specific factors that, and the processes that have developed. So finally, just want to again emphasize this point that for us, history is not a kind of teleological thing. It's not some sort of situation where capitalism will just inevitably end of its own accord, inevitably collapse, and you'll have the rise of socialism without us having to do anything. I mean, if that was the case, then we could all go home now and save ourselves a lot of time and effort. The point is, obviously, that we can play an important role in history, and that we have to play an important role in history, and that socialism, far from being the end of history, will really be the beginning of history. It'll be, if you like, the first time where we're really consciously able to plan our what we do, our actions, how production, how society is organized. You know, the original contradiction, if you like, in society was a contradiction between man and nature, in the sense that mankind was at the mercy of his surroundings. It was a struggle just to survive, just to meet the basic material needs. And this was overcome, this contradiction between man and nature. This was overcome through the development of production, through development of science, technology, and the ability to manipulate our surroundings to our own advantage. In the process of doing this, we obviously created new contradictions. We created the contradiction not of man versus nature, but man versus man. We created the contradiction of a class struggle, which now kind of imposes itself in terms of capitalism, as something that seems to hover above us, that asserts its laws independently of us, that seems to dominate all of society in a irrational and anarchic way. Socialism, in this sense, as I said, will be the beginning of history, because for the first time, we can put an end to this kind of anarchical and anarchic irrational madness. We can actually be masters of our own destiny for the first time in history. And I think, in that sense, I'd like to end with a quote by Engels, who said, "With the seizing of the means of production by society, the production of commodities is done away with, and simultaneously the mastery of the product over the producer. Anarchy in social production is replaced by systematic, definite organization. The struggle for individual existence disappears. Then, for the first time, man, in a certain sense, is finally marked off from the rest of the animal kingdom and emerges from mere animal conditions of existence into really human ones. The laws of his own social action, hitherto standing face to face with man as laws of nature, foreign to and dominating him, will then be used with full understanding and so mastered by him. Only from that time will man himself, more and more consciously, make his own history. Only from that time will the social causes set in movement by him have, in the main and in a constantly growing measure, the results intended by him. It is the ascent of man from the kingdom of necessity to the kingdom of freedom." And that's what we're trying to build, comrades, with socialism. Thank you.